public hanging. Yes, I know to be public hanging. There'll be music, I'll be public hanging.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is the Republic Broadcasting Network. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Also write for antiwar.com. And very special show for you today. Second hour will just be me reading the bad news and taking your calls. But in the first hour, got Daniel Ellsberg. He's a former company commander in the Marines. He holds a doctorate in economics from Harvard. And while working for the Rand Corporation for the Pentagon in 1971, he leaked the Pentagon Papers, destroying the lies surrounding the Vietnam War. His book is Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. His websites are ellsberg.net, that's ellsberg.net, and truthtellingproject.org. Welcome to the show, sir.
Good to be here. Thank you, Scott.
Well, it's an honor to have you on, sir. Am I correct to understand that the crimes committed against you by the Nixon administration are part of what brought them down?
Yes, that's well put, really, and not very generally understood. The crimes that were committed against the Democratic National Committee headquarters in the Watergate and the campaign contributions and the dirty tricks in the campaign, which are usually associated with Watergate, weren't actually traced to Richard Nixon, so they didn't. They did put a lot of his subordinates in jail, but they weren't really too threatening to Nixon because they've never been connected directly to him. The people who could have connected him to those directly didn't talk, like his Attorney General Mitchell or his Chief of Staff Haldeman. But crimes that he committed against me, ordered from the Oval Office, were witnessed by a number of people. Who could talk and who were willing to talk and who had to be kept quiet by bribing them, people like Howard Hunt, who had to be paid a good deal of money to lie to the grand jury about what he knew about those crimes. And those were new crimes of obstruction of justice, known to John Dean, the counsel who was running the cover-up. So when they tried to pin the whole cover-up on Dean, he turned on them and talked to the prosecutors about these Oval Office crimes. And those were crucial, ultimately, in threatening Nixon with impeachment and forcing him to resign.
And it was their persecution of you, really, that got you off the hook from the 115-year sentence you were facing for stealing the Pentagon Papers, right?
Well, it ended the trial. We don't know what the jury would have done. They certainly, we know from talking to them afterwards, that they were going to reject the charges of violations of the Espionage Act, the charges that had hurt national security. Some of the other charges, they were waiting to hear from the judge what his instructions were to decide. So we don't know what the jury would have done, actually. Had a good chance of getting off and a good chance of not getting off on some of those charges. But the trial was ended because of the discovery of what the judge called a pattern of wrongdoing that offends, by government wrongdoing, that offends a sense of justice and that precluded a fair trial of me. So he dismissed the charges without the possibility of my being charged again.
Now, according to your Wikipedia entry, it says it definitely in your book here, you kind of bring it up as a possibility that Nixon actually hired CIA hitmen to come and murder you.
Yeah, that's more than a possibility, although the word murder was certainly not used. The words used by according to the prosecutor of these people were that they were brought up a dozen CIA assets who had been involved in the Bay of Pigs, to start with, and other, in some cases, other assassination plots.
All right, well, we're going to have to find out all about that right after this break. We'll be right back with Daniel Ellsberg on the Weekend Interview Show. Welcome Welcome back to the show, everybody. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Daniel Ellsberg. If it wasn't for him, we might still be fighting the Vietnam War. And before we went out to break, sir, you were describing CIA Cuban hitmen who were sent to take care of you.
That's right. Well, the words I was going to say was the prosecutor told me that their orders were to incapacitate me totally.
Oh, I see. Well, that sounds a little bit nicer than, you know, outright shoot you in the back of the head, right?
Oh, well, I asked him, well, what does that mean, kill me? And he said, well, the words were incapacitate you totally. But he said, you have to understand, these guys never use the word kill.
Oh, they were just going to render you into a permanent vegetative state, though.
Well, that's possible. They put me in a very secure location, maybe. But they used words like neutralize, that is in their writing, or we heard the words, terminate with extreme prejudice. That's a CIA term.
Well, I think the fact that you lived through this, really, you get to wear this as a badge of honor, right? That Nixon wanted you murdered?
That's right. It's again, let's avoid that word murder.
Wanted
me incapacitated. I actually, the prosecutor William Merrill thought that did mean kill. I don't think so. It's a range of things. I think they wanted me silent for a particular period, just when they attacked me. It was just before the mining of Haiphong, which I was talking about and predicting. And I think they wanted me out of the public dialogue for a week or two only, maybe a broken jaw or something like that, but in the hospital. That's my best guess. But, of course, either way, it was a crime, and even though they backed away from it because they thought they were going to get caught and be scapegoats, as one of them put it, like Oswald, whatever that means. But they backed off, and that night they were taken on a reconnaissance of their next target, which was the Watergate. And they were caught in the Watergate weeks later on their second entry into it. And then, of course, they had other things to talk about to prosecutors, unless they were kept quiet, and they were kept quiet by bribes. Although some of them were quite willing to keep their mouths shut for the boss. Gordon Liddy, and sort of his life's ambition was to be a stand-up guy and take the rap for a boss or a Führer. He was an admirer of Hitler. I don't know if he still is or not, as a syndicated columnist, but very openly an admirer of Hitler at that point, and I think in the SS. And his ambition was to show his willingness to sacrifice himself for a boss. But Howard Hunt had to be paid.
And it was really, that was the hush money, that was the obstruction of justice, right? Was that
right, yeah.
Nixon got the CIA to interfere in the FBI's investigation of the hush money.
Nixon saying to his counsel, Dean, who was covering up, Dean says, well, it would take $1 million, you know, to keep these guys quiet, pay their legal fees and their families and whatnot. And Nixon said, $1 million, well, that could be found. I know where that could be found. That was fairly damning.
All right, well,
he did find it.
Let's get back to exactly why these people were out to get you in the first place. You had leaked a 7,000-page secret history of the Vietnam War that went all the way from the Truman years after World War II all the way through 1968.
Right. And that was just Johnson. That wasn't Nixon. So it didn't indict Nixon directly, although he'd been vice president during the Eisenhower years when there was a lot of lying. But he wasn't directly implicated in the papers. So actually, he was quite happy to see these things come out incriminating the Democrats and showing their lies and their bad judgment. And it was the precedent that he didn't like of an individual taking it on himself to tell the truth about this. He had to worry that somebody would follow that precedent in his administration, and that's why he put me on trial. But then he learned, having indicted me, that I had some documents on him, which he presumed had come from some source in his own National Security Council, and he had to worry that I might have almost anything on him, and that included nuclear threats that he'd been making secretly since 69 to the North Vietnam and telling the Russians and Chinese about them as well. He didn't want the American people to know what he was saying to these other people and the likelihood that could lead to nuclear war. In particular. And he had other escalations in mind, including the mining of Haiphong and possible invasion of North Vietnam. So lest I worry the American public by bringing out documents that would prove all that, he had to keep me quiet. And he had a problem there. He couldn't do it just by threatening me with indictment. I was indicted already, facing 115 years in prison, 12 felony counts. And that had apparently stopped me from talking about him. So he wasn't even that worried about my talking about him. He was worried about my putting documents out at some point. So he hired these same, these Cubans, this was an earlier operation, under Hunt and Liddy, to go into my former psychoanalyst's office to try to find files and get information that would embarrass me enough if I were threatened with its release, that I would keep quiet. In other words, it wasn't just to smear me or discredit me, as is usually said. It was to threaten me, blackmail me with threats, with the possibility of exposure of something I didn't want out. And if I were to keep talking or put out any documents, well, they didn't find what they wanted, and they couldn't have kept me quiet that way anyway. And they only had two other ways, and one was to incapacitate me totally, which they did try later. And the, I should say one other way. So they did that later when they could, and that again, as I say, were crimes that had to be kept quiet.
It's kind of a funny irony in your book that it turns out that the secret documents that you had on the Nixon era that you'd gotten while you were working on a study for Henry Kissinger, and if Kissinger had only told his boss, look, I'm where he got the document, and I know exactly what it is he had, they wouldn't have had anything to worry about because they would have known what it was you had and what you didn't have. Am I right?
Right. That's right. What it amounts to is that Watergate, in the part that actually brought Nixon down, which was, as I say, very largely what he did against the anti-war movement, but in particular against me, was really strongly connected. Watergate then was strongly connected with his secret Vietnam policy, which is realized by almost no one, and his determination to keep the war going until he'd succeeded. And to keep that policy secret, he was led to take crimes against somebody who was inclined to, was ready to put out the truth. And those crimes did help bring him down, which was crucial to ending the war. I think that if he had stayed in office, which depended on a lot of luck almost, or revelations by other people to get him out, if Dean hadn't revealed what he did, if Alexander Butterfield in his office had not revealed the taping, he would have stayed in office despite the allegations against him. And if he'd stayed in office, I think he would have continued the war in the air, even if Congress had cut off the money, which it did. They forbade use of government funds for combat operations in Vietnam after mid-August 1973. I think Nixon would have found that money, just the way Reagan found it against the will of Congress to keep the covert terrorism against Nicaragua going. Found it from Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and diverting other government funds to it against unconstitutionally. So to get the war over, you had to have Nixon out of there and have the money cut off, because Nixon's successor, Ford, was not willing to violate the congressional will to that extent. I think Nixon would have done it. So it was crucial, it turned out. It depended on papers, but more significantly, it turned out just by... I couldn't foresee this. The other documents that I'd copied that dealt directly with Nixon, and the threat those posed to him, in particular because he didn't know just how much I had. He suspected I had more than I did. And if I hadn't copied those and had only put out the Pentagon Papers, I think he would have stayed in office, and the war would have continued.
Real quickly, sir, you talk about secrecy and access and influence and how it's easy in the mind of someone who works in the executive branch to get so caught up in the idea that because they're in the position to know and nobody else does, that it's okay that they keep all these secrets and decide all their policies in secret.
Well, they share an attitude that most of the public shares. The president has more information than anyone else, and he's the one who's been elected, and he should carry out the policy. People should not question it. Exactly. And that's very plausible to people inside as well as out. They feel the public has no real business in this. They'll only muck it up. Congress feels the same way, and the executive feels that way about Congress.
All right, we'll be right back with Daniel Ellsberg on the Weekend Interview Show. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Daniel Ellsberg, American hero. And I want to know a little bit of background here, sir. Can you please tell us about how it was that you began working for RAND and the Department of Defense?
I had worked on problems of decision-making under uncertainty, so-called field of economics or psychology, known as decision theory and statistics, and I'd done that at Harvard. So I was recommended for working at the RAND Corporation because they had a number of people working on those problems. And when I got there as a summer consultant to see if we were a match, I discovered that they were applying this theory, or that there was a chance to apply this theoretical understanding of decision-making under uncertainty to the most crucial questions of uncertainty, it seemed to me, in the world, such as how to deter a Soviet surprise attack against the United States and how to decide how to respond to such an attack if you thought that it might be imminent or might be going on. The question, by the way, that has gotten so prominent in the last couple of years of preemption, of anticipating an imminent attack, speaking now in President Bush's terms of a conventional attack or an attack with, he calls WMDs, weapons of mass destruction. That question has been around for a long time. And the notion that Bush invented the idea that you should anticipate such an attack if you knew that it was imminent is wrong. That's always been the secret basis of our policy, actually, to move first if mushroom clouds are about to appear on our territory, and you know that. No president has ever committed himself to waiting until those explosions occurred. Quite the contrary. Our plans have always been based on preempting that. But he was using the word preemption. He has been in a very misleading way. Bush, of course, was talking not about when an attack of some sort is imminent, but when it might occur sometime in the future, even the fairly distant future of years from now or a decade from now. Shouldn't we do something about that beforehand? He really was launching a preventive war against Iraq on the grounds that they might someday or were likely someday to acquire weapons, but not at all that there was any imminent threat of attack. And anyway, what I was looking at RAND was distinctly preemptive in the possibility that the president, under being told that radar and infrared and perhaps other intelligence indicated that an attack was on the way, that missiles were coming within a matter of minutes, but he wasn't sure of that. Under what actions might he take under those circumstances without being sure, for example, launching our planes or launching command and control? That I worked on the command and control of nuclear weapons, how to be sure that you would respond if there was an attack and would not if there weren't an attack, how to avoid a false alarm. I was working then on nuclear policy. And I came to be knowledgeable about that, and to a degree that I was called on to consult at a high level in the Defense Department.
And you were the special assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense, McNaughton, right?
That was a little later. I, after participating in the Cuban Missile Crisis on this question, really, of interpreting what would be the danger posed by 40-odd Soviet missiles on Cuba, I was spending nights all week in the Pentagon on that question and saw in retrospect that we'd come very close to launching a nuclear war and to disastrous effect, that there was possibility. I began studying crises, did a large crisis study for the Pentagon and the State Department, and that led to my being asked to serve in the Defense Department on what my future boss described as an ongoing crisis, an endless crisis in Vietnam, and that would teach me a lot more about crisis decision-making than I could get just by studying it as a consultant. And that proved to be the case. Vietnam, by the way, turned out to be more of a nuclear crisis than people on the other side ever realized because, as I've said, Nixon in particular, but even to some degree Johnson, were secretly threatening nuclear strikes in a way that our enemies knew because they were getting these threats. But the public was never allowed to know because it would have worried them and lost support for the policy.
It's interesting the way you tell the story in your book. It seems that the Joint Chiefs of Staff are always pushing for the most radical move in policy, and the civilians in the pinstripe suits are always sort of trying to rein them in, which seems to be the exact opposite situation what we have today, where the neoconservatives in their pinstripe suits are the ones with all the grand ideas, and the military is telling them, well, you know, you sure you want to do that? I don't know.
That's true. There has been really a reversal there. The military in the time of Vietnam were not pressing for the use of nuclear weapons. What they were doing, though, was strongly recommending actions of escalation that were quite likely to bring the Chinese communists into North Vietnam and to lead to a nuclear war. And so, and that was explicit. They recognized when they were pushed to that, yes, nuclear weapons had to be last resort there and might be necessary. It wasn't that they were pressing them right away, but they were pressing for major escalation.
All right, we'll be right back with Daniel Ellsberg.
Don't take your guns to town.
All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Daniel Ellsberg, the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers and brought down Richard Nixon, or at least was persecuted in such a way by Richard Nixon that he brought down himself. Anyway, when we were going out to break there, sir, we were talking about, specifically in terms of nuclear policy, but this is a theme that I've encountered pretty much all throughout your book, is that the problem in Vietnam was how to win the war without bringing the Chinese into it. Because if you're too successful, then the Chinese are going to pour over the border. So it was always a no-win situation. Am I right?
That's true. That's putting it almost at the most optimistic, because it implies that if you could be sure the Chinese wouldn't come in, we would win. Actually, that was the Joint Chiefs, I think, did believe that. I think they were wrong. They were terribly wrong about that. There was no way to win. Any more, I believe, than there is a way to win in Iraq right now. And I think the Joint Chiefs now are much clearer on that than their predecessors were, or than their civilians' bosses are right now. I'm just reading the news today about discussions in Congress just the other day with Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. And I'm thinking, on the one hand, he sounds just like McNamara, in a period when McNamara was telling the country and the Congress that we were making progress at that time. I was thinking it's also possible that Rumsfeld has gotten wise by this time and that he knows as well as McNamara did at that time that what he's saying is nonsense, that when he says that we're not in a quagmire, it's just possible that Rumsfeld knows that's a lie and recognizes very well that he is in a quagmire. He would be saying the same thing either way. And we'd be stuck in the quagmire, whichever, whether he knew it or not, because, of course, he's endorsing a policy of keeping us there.
Speaking of quagmire, you talk about how in the Pentagon Papers, you learn from reading them that the popular model of understanding Vietnam of the time was Schlesinger's quagmire model, that America had made commitments here and made commitments there in order a step at a time, and expanded the war a step at a time, always thinking they were really doing the right thing, but in fact they were just making matters worse. And you say in the book that upon reading the Pentagon Papers, you realized that that quagmire model for Vietnam was not accurate.
Well, we certainly were in a quagmire. It was hard to get out, and it showed no promise of any kind of success. What I was questioning was the usual model of how we got there, and Schlesinger and others, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and others, did accept the notion that the military had pulled us in by being over-optimistic and saying that one more little effort would do the job and that it would be fairly quick and easy. They'd never said that. they were in favor of going in, unlike, I think, our military in Iraq. They were in favor of going into Vietnam, but only on a big way and with the understanding that it was going to be a big, long war. And it was the president who misled the public on that ground by implying to them that victory was just around the corner and that one more little effort would do it, when he knew that we were in for very much bigger escalation. As a matter of fact, he was sending more troops than he admitted at the time. He would authorize sending, say, 100,000 for the next slice and tell the public that it was only 50,000 and figure on telling them later that there was a later request for another 50,000. I think there may be a counterpart to that going on right now, by the way. When Rumsfeld and Bush say that they have sent all the troops that the military say are needed in Iraq, and we don't need any more, I feel certain, I would give very high odds, that that's a flat lie. Everybody in the world can see that we don't have enough troops to do the missions we've undertaken right now, that you're having to pull troops back that you promised to let go, and you're pulling them back because there aren't enough troops to do the job. And the ones who are there are working double shifts, if not triple shifts sometimes, just to accomplish the missions that they've taken on, let alone anything more ambitious. And they're not winning the war, as General Abizaid said the other day, very clearly contradicting Cheney. So it's obvious that you need more troops. Now, why are they denying that? Well, because you can't get more troops without if you keep the mission without a draft. And for political reasons, they don't want a draft. So they're trying to pretend that these totally overworked troops, who are at the end of their rope in many cases, and no doubt are dying to some degree because of fatigue and on lack of caution, just from exhaustion. They're trying to pretend that, no, yeah, that's fine. I would say it's virtually certain that the military have made it clear to the civilians that if you want to keep these missions going, if you want to keep in Iraq and to keep going, let alone to be more successful, you have to have more troops. And the administration is simply lying about that.
Well, but they can only go on like this for so long. What do you think is the tipping point where they're going to have to go ahead and admit that they need to double their forces there?
I think that this is a speculation, though. It is hard to see how they could imagine getting a draft out of the public this month or next month with popular support for the war obviously slipping away. And that's another exchange that went on that's somehow very reminiscent of Vietnam. Two Republican senators, McCain and Lindsey Graham and another one, Susan Collins, all raised the question that public support was ebbing for the war. And Rumsfeld said at one point, well, you're saying that the public is tipping against support for the war. I say it's being pushed. Well, pushed by who? In the old days, you would have said by Moscow or Beijing or money or something like that, or a totally disloyal anti-war movement. We're talking about centrist public here now, that isn't, and there's a lack of the center of evil here now that we had at that point. Is Osama bin Laden bribing CBS, for example? That question doesn't seem plausible. What he's not willing to face up to, of course, is that even though they don't take pictures of the coffins coming home, even though that's forbidden, President Bush isn't attending any funerals as if there weren't any, so it's not to draw attention to them. The fact is the public does have the picture that there are Americans dying over there and killing over there without any prospect of success that they can see. That's the way it was in Vietnam, and that's why the support is going down. Well, how could they change that then? I think another terrorist attack, which is to be expected sooner or later from Osama bin Laden, from al-Qaeda, would be, in my opinion, an occasion for them to declare a kind of state of emergency and in that state to go for a draft. Say, things are getting even more serious, and among the things we have to do is to have a draft. And in that state of perhaps panic and, as we had last time, understandable concern about the threat to America, I think he'd get away with it.
Well, it's always that provocation. And another parallel with Vietnam and the current war in Iraq, we know we were lied into the war in Iraq about with all these promises of storehouses full of sarin and VX nerve gas that we were going to find, etc. But I found in your book that your first day on the job working for Assistant Secretary of Defense McNaughton was the day of the second Gulf of Tonkin incident?
That's right. Well, that supposed incident, a supposed attack, which didn't in fact take place, but was believed in for some hours or days, was used to get a undated declaration of war out of Congress, the same way as 9/11 was used even a year later to get an undated declaration of war, a delegation of their war powers from Congress to the president to go against Iraq, and even earlier was used to get go against Afghanistan. The case for going against Afghanistan was much greater. Anything would be greater. There was no case, real case, against Iraq. There was a case against Afghanistan, but for Congress to delegate that power without having had hearings, without having any real debate, just to sign it over, was something that, unfortunately, only one member of Congress had the guts and the commitment to constitutional principles to oppose, and that was Barbara Lee. But no one wanted to seem disloyal to the president or unpatriotic and unsupportive to raise any fuss.
And in fact, that resolution didn't even give him permission to invade Afghanistan. It gave him permission to hunt down the people responsible for the attacks, not anybody who might be near them.
They left it up to the president to decide who that might be or where that might be, and it was pretty much of an unlimited matter. Since he was claiming that Iraq was involved falsely, he could have used that probably to go against Iraq right away, and that's what Rumsfeld wanted to do, as has been revealed by Richard Clark working for him, and by Bob Woodward's account based on inside sources, that immediately Rumsfeld wanted to hit Iraq, even though he was told that it had nothing to do with 9/11, told by Richard Clark. And his response to that was, but there are no good targets in Afghanistan. Iraq was where they wanted to hit.
It was doable.
They saw that as an opportunity then to hit a country they'd been wanting to invade for some time, even 10 years for some of them, which even though it had nothing to do with the immediate crisis.
I want to get back into the mindset of some of these people in the executive branch. You tell the story in your book of when Kissinger was named to be the foreign policy assistant to Richard Nixon, that you had a chance to talk with him and warn him about what happens to people who have access to secret information and how they end up thinking that they're so smart they don't have to listen to anybody else and that kind of thing. And I wonder what kind of parallels you see between that kind of way of thinking in the Vietnam era and today.
Of course, there's more information secret now by this administration than by any other. They've compartmented more. They are using much more of the defense budget is what is called the black budget, which means it doesn't even get discussed or debated at all by Congress or in the committees as a whole, but is known only to a few members of Congress because it's being disguised as money going somewhere else. In the Defense Department, well, a large proportion of the black of the defense budget now is now really outside the general Congress, and it could hardly be less constitutional than that. If there was one principle they were trying to establish, it was that Congress should be in charge of the funds, or as well as the power to declare war and to get us into a war. Well, that latter power has, as I've just been talking about, has been pretty well eroded in the sense of being handed over to the president and not just by this Congress. But Congress in the past at least kept its hands on the money pretty carefully and audited that. And they've really signed away an awful lot of that by this time. Who know what the secrets are feel, well, if they're talking to somebody who doesn't have the same clearances, then they have to feel, have to ask themselves, now what advice would I be hearing from this person if he knew what I knew? Would he be saying the same things, or would it be quite different? And that's a rather complicated exercise to carry out, and people just get tired of it and they stop listening to people who don't have the clearances. They talk only to the people who do have the clearances, even though some of them may have no background, no expertise or experience in that area, but they have the clearance. They have the trust that they'll keep their mouth shut and that they'll be loyal to the administration, and that's enough to put them in the policy dispute. That may not lead, it doesn't lead to very good policy.
And on the question of where the power belongs in the Congress or in the presidency, it sort of goes without saying almost nowadays that everybody knows that foreign policy is for the president to decide, and you know, if it's really bad, then I guess the Senate can say no, but for the most part, the president's just supposed to be able to do whatever he wants in foreign policy. And the funny thing is that if you actually read Article 2 of the Constitution, it doesn't say that anywhere. All the policy and laws are supposed to be passed by the legislative branch.
It's the to hand foreign policy entirely to the president and to enable him to be the sole judge of what the public shall know about that, and or the Congress shall know about that, is to make him a king, an elected king, perhaps, or an almost elected king in recent cases, but a king. I think Tom Paine had it right when he was urging the American colonists to reject the idea of a king, which was so hallowed in tradition, not only in Britain. And he said, it's the pride of kings throws mankind into confusion. It's the pride of kings that leads to unnecessary wars and to wars. And the reason for giving that power to Congress, which the constitutional founders did later, rather than president, is not because Congress is smarter or has more information, but because they are less as a body representative and more responsible to the people. They are less likely, less prone to see domestic advantage in causing a war or to see advantage to themselves or prestige or you know, we've just gotten a revelation from the last month, a few weeks actually, from a guy who was ghosting a book with or for Bush back in 1999, who has revealed that in his discussions with Bush at that time, well before the campaign, that Bush felt that successful presidents had always had a military victory under their belt for domestic purposes, in the sense that they were able to use, quote, the political capital they gained from being a successful war leader to get through their domestic program. He felt his own father had failed on that. He said that his father had had a lot of political capital, quote, as a result of his successful Gulf War, but he let it slip away. He didn't use it. And Bush's attitude was, I would use it in that situation. And obviously that's what he had in mind in this case. He has not used it very effectively because the war didn't give him that much power over the course of a year or two. It didn't look successful and is never going to be successful. But it does look strongly from that as though Bush had no doubt a variety of motives for going into Iraq, but at least one of them was to get through a fairly radical conservative political program, so-called conservative, if running up trillions of dollars of debt is be called conservative, but in transferring wealth enormously to the very highest percentage of income distribution. It's not conservative in a sort of traditional sense, but right-wing and far right-wing. And that he did see a successful war as crucial to that.
Well, and his theory holds water, too. I mean, everybody, every historian's favorite presidents are the ones who killed the most. Franklin Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln and Harry Truman. And, you know, oh, wow, he dropped nukes on people. He's definitely top five.
Well,
I'm sorry. Hold it right there, sir. We're about to go out to break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Daniel Ellsberg on the Weekend Interview Show. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm so lucky I'm talking to Daniel Ellsberg, and he's agreed to go ahead and stay over for a little bit longer into the next hour. So, since we only got a little five-minute segment here, I think let's go ahead and spend this time talking about the various whistleblower projects and such, and then we can get back into the heart of the story of Vietnam and Iraq in the, at the beginning of the next hour. But I want to tell you all first that Daniel Ellsberg's website is Daniel... Oh, no, it's not. It's Ellsberg.net. ELLSBERG.net. And also... he's got another website called truthtellingproject.org. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, Mr. Ellsberg?
Well, a number of people who'd had clearances in the government, like myself, but people from agencies like the FBI, CIA, military intelligence, but also State Department, et cetera, really got together who felt that... what was needed now is for some support and encouragement of people to put out the truth that they knew, even at risk to their own careers or to their own lives, freedom, in order to save lives in Iraq, to shorten the war. It would have been good to avert the war. I've been telling people that don't do what I did. Don't wait till the bombs are falling or the we're years into the war, another... such as another war, like Iran. Don't wait till thousands more have died before telling the truth that you know of, if you have documents that can show that the public is being misled and we're in a wrongful and hopeless situation. We all feel sure, there's more than a dozen of us who signed a declaration to this effect. We all feel sure that there are hundreds and probably thousands of people in the government who see the current situation in just those terms. Obviously, there are probably some people at the top, perhaps Wolfowitz, who just went to the World Bank, who is quite confident that we're doing the right thing and we're on the right course. Rumsfeld talks that way. I'm not sure he's so stupid as to believe that anymore. But at one point, he was dumb enough and intelligent to believe that. Intelligence is no obstacle to believing some very dumb things. Matter of fact, and I'm not free of that. Nobody else has been. I believed a lot of what we were doing in Vietnam when I went over there. But some people learn. I'm suggesting that just conceivably Rumsfeld has learned, and we can't tell by what he says because his job is to lie to the president significantly as a high number of the administration. Maybe I'm giving him too much credit there. Others, however, certainly do know that, and they are doing some leaking. Question is, at what scale? I would really like to see deep throats, let's say, like Mark Felt, as has just been revealed, is that we need more Mark Felts now. He didn't put out nearly what he could have said at the time, and he didn't put out documents. But at least he did help newsmen get toward them, point them toward the truth at that time. And we need a lot more of that. We need... for example, the Downing Street memo is getting a lot of attention in England, and very little here, but a small growing amount, thanks to Conyers and others. And attention here, well, that's the minutes of a meeting talking about meetings in Washington. Now, those meetings in Washington had American minutes and memos written on them. Why are we, well, I think, why aren't we getting those? Well, because they're secret, sensitive, and they're being kept from the public. That was true of the Downing Street minutes, too, in England. Somebody there was patriotic enough and courageous enough to put their career on the line and give that to the public. And it's causing a very important debate in England and possible, ultimately, accountability to Blair, for Blair. That should be happening over here.
All right. We'll be right back with Daniel Ellsberg. Friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I thank Dan Ellsberg for staying over into the second hour a little bit with us here. And we're talking about Vietnam. We're talking about Iraq and some of the differences and similarities between those two conflicts. On Vietnam, real quick, Mr. Ellsberg, You say in the book that the Vietnam War was never even a civil war. Oftentimes, people who were against the Vietnam War say, well, it was a civil war that we had no business even intervening in the first place. But you say that it really wasn't even a civil war. It was simply the American invasion of Vietnam. How do you explain that?
A very close analogy to Iraq here right now. Would anybody say that the violence going on in Iraq right now is essentially a civil war?
Not yet.
I don't think so. That doesn't mean that real civil war isn't possible sometime in the future. But what's drawing the various factions in Iraq together right now is their one thing, really, and that's their shared opposition to American occupation. Now, aren't they killing Iraqis, and aren't Iraqis shooting at them? That's true, as was true in Vietnam. But the Iraqis mainly being hit, like the police, security forces that were trained there and so forth, are Iraqis who, at a time of vast unemployment in Iraq, are signing up for a regular weekly, monthly stipend, essentially from the U.S. They're hiring out the foreigners. Isn't there a government, an Iraqi government to which they respond? Yes, it's an Iraqi government in elections that are presided over by a huge American occupation force in which the chance, for example, of a referendum on the U.S. remaining there was very clearly ruled out. And that was exactly like Vietnam. The Vietnamese who were dying in large numbers at the hands of other Vietnamese, the NLF attacking them and so forth, were Vietnamese that were paid by foreigners and equipped and trained by foreigners, wore American boots and American helmets. And that was not a civil war. When one side is entirely financed and equipped and impelled, basically, by the interests of foreigners, that's not a civil war. The other side was getting some support from outside, from the Soviets and from East Europe and from China, but it was on the level of, say, 10% of what we were supplying to our side, and it was not a 10% that was in any way critical to their effort, except, for example, for the surface-to-air missiles that Russia gave North Vietnam with which to oppose our airplanes. But their side in South Vietnam didn't have airplanes. We didn't use any surface-to-air missiles ourselves in South Vietnam. There was nobody but our own planes to aim them at. They didn't have tanks. They didn't have artillery. They had mortars, essentially, and rockets, which is pretty well true in Iraq as so far also. So it's a war then. There was a war against foreign occupation, both cases.
There's a pretty big difference in the two, I mean, besides the obvious things like, you know, communism versus Islam and jungle versus desert and that kind of obvious stuff. There's also,
I often say it's a dry heat.
Yeah.
That's the kind of big difference there is. And the language that our soldiers and diplomats don't speak, the local language, is Arabic rather than Vietnamese.
Right. Well, but also you had a situation in Vietnam where you had a strong national leader, Ho Chi Minh, whereas the insurgency, I'm not sure, necessarily has that broad support. But anyway, we've got to go out to this break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the sames and differences in the Iraq War and the Vietnam War with Daniel Ellsberg, whistleblower.
16 years.
All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. I keep all the archives for you there in MP3 format for you. And I'm talking with the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg. His websites are ellsberg.net and truthtellingproject.org. Now, we're talking about the differences and similarities in America's two conflicts in Vietnam and Iraq. And Iraq is a bit different in that they do not have a unifying national leader like Ho Chi Minh, who is even very popular in South Vietnam. If there was ever a national unifying leader in Iraq, it was Saddam Hussein. So do you think that the insurgency in Iraq has less of a chance of being able to hang in there over the long term as compared to the Viet Cong?
No, I don't, because you're right that there is the difference there in the nature of the leadership. There's nothing corresponding to Ho Chi Minh as a unifying factor, but really the nationalism there seems to be just as tenacious as in Vietnam. I don't know enough about the area to have been able to predict that one way or the other, really, but it turns out that people who were expert in the area did foresee that, including many military people. It's interesting, by the way, that the ones who saw that the occupation was going to be very difficult and require great numbers of troops for us just to hang in there and to keep our bases, people like General Shinseki, who was chief of staff of the army, and I'm sure, by the way, he wasn't a personal expert on this, but he obviously had very good staff studies, and he said we would need 300 or 400,000 troops to do that, and he's denounced by Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld as being totally off the mark, and he was essentially fired or forced out. He wasn't actually literally fired, but he was forced to retire early. His retirement was announced early, making him a lame duck. So he's not there. And Powell, who obviously had great reservations about it, but hung in there and lied for the president, nevertheless is not there now. Rumsfeld still is there. It would be good. Rumsfeld was asked just the other day in these hearings by Senator Kennedy, isn't it time for him to resign? Well, I think I don't know exactly how he answered that. I didn't see it in the story. But an answer would be, you know, that's for the president to decide. Fair enough. But the president himself should be pressed, I think, on the question of, were there people who advised you that there was no need for large numbers of troops in the immediate aftermath of the invasion, and who thought that this would be quick and easy? And are those people still there? Or are they gone? Now, one of those is known to be Wolfowitz, and he's gone to the World Bank. But others are still there, and the president, I think, should be pressed as to why are they still there, and why have you chosen to rely on people of such poor judgment? The accountability in the end does point up to the president.
Well, and that is another strong parallel with Vietnam, too, where they basically knew all along that the best we can do is put off losing.
That's right, and the people who were really very prescient about this and predicted catastrophe, like George Ball and some others, Bill Moyers, were let go. They weren't literally fired, actually, but they got disillusioned and frustrated, and there was no attempt to keep them there or to rely on their judgment because they were saying to get out, just as some Republicans, a few Republicans, have begun to say right now, to their credit. And I'm not sure it's not more Republicans than Democrats at this point. The Democrats are so intimidated by the fear, the justified fear of being called cowardly and unpatriotic and disloyal. And it's true. They are getting those names, and they will get those names if they say what needs to be said. But the alternative of keeping quiet and being cheerleaders and saying we must stay the course is to condemn many more Americans and 10 to 100 times as many Iraqis to death.
Well, you know, when you say stay the course like that, it sort of sounds, doesn't have much substance to it in the first place, you know, especially when we realize that the course that we're on was a mistaken course in the first place. But if you put it another way, if you turn the same statement around, really, and just say, but we can't just withdraw, isn't that the same argument that you heard in the 60s and 70s? Well, we all know we can't win, but we can't just leave now.
I know many people said, even ones who claimed that they had seen this disaster from early on, still said, nevertheless, now we're there, or as Henry Kissinger put it, you know, whatever the values were in the first place, now we have a vital interest in Vietnam, and that is not to be seen as running away, cutting and running. By the way, and many Democrats said the same, unfortunately. I was struck by a letter writer to the New York Times the other day who used the expression, it's time to cut and walk. And I like that. Running, of course, sounds like, you know, running away, turning your back, and being vulnerable and weak and unmanly. The other expression reminded me really of a sign we see a lot in theaters. You know, you're forbidden, even in a regime of free speech, to shout falsely, fire in a crowded theater, as Oliver Wendell Holmes put it. But the theater is on fire. Actually, and the time has come, I would say, to say calmly and very clearly and audibly, walk, do not run to the nearest exit.
There's an anecdote in your book, and oh, again, I should mention, the name of the book is Secrets, A Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers by Daniel Ellsberg. And you have an anecdote in the book of your friend John Van, who had a lot of experience in Vietnam for years and years among the locals and spoke the language and really understood what was going on there. And in this anecdote, you have the National Security Advisor, Walt Rostow, saying, ah, the war will be over in a year. And John Van says, oh, I don't know. I think we can probably last a little longer than that.
Yeah, that's pretty close. Yeah, he never got to see Rostow again after saying that. But, you know, a truth, a very unhappy truth, though I would have to say it's not encouraging and inspiring, but I think it's a reality, is this. Can the U.S., that is, in the usual shorthand, meaning the White House, claims to speak and manages to speak for the public as long as we let him, and that's very long. Can they stay the course for a long time? And I'm afraid the answer is yes. That means, in part, can the White House, Democrat or Republican, withstand the growing disillusion and dismay among the public and a desire to get out? Yes. The Nixon White House withstood that for years and years very well. And I think, as I say, without Watergate, as we said earlier, the war would have gone on much longer than it did, despite the fact that the public wanted out, as shown in the polls. And the fact that the polls show that now does not tell us that either this administration will get out. I mean, we can all see that's very unlikely. It doesn't tell us the next administration will get out either, whether it's Democrat or Republican. The truth is that once they're in, this fear of being called losers and defeatists and weak will keep people in for a long time, even though the public is urging them to get out. They don't trust that they'll be forgiven if they're defeated anyway. But there's a much more concrete aim here at stake than was ever true in Vietnam. Will an American administration, Democratic or Republican, let go of the oil of Iraq? There was no significant amount of oil in Vietnam. There was some hopes for the South China Sea that have never panned out as much as was hoped, but that wasn't a critical issue. And our bases there were very, we got along without them very well. There's nothing crucial about them. But the idea of having permanent bases in, which we're building, in the middle of the Middle East there, and sitting on top of the second largest reserves of oil, and in part protecting Israel, at that point, I think these are things that no administration is going to find easy or even possible to walk away from. And that means that, I'm sorry to say, we may stay the course far longer than we should. We shouldn't be there at all. But you'd like to say that now that these stupid, unrealistic hopes of immediate victory and being greeted with sweets and flowers when we arrive, those got disproved pretty fast. And one could say, you'd hope that we would adjust our policy rather quickly and see that we were hurting our security. We are hurting our security every week and day and hour that we stay there. They're recruiting more people who want to kill Americans.
And just think, how much oil could we have bought for $300 billion? A lot.
Well, yes, but it isn't just the question of buying the oil. The attraction of Iraq in particular is to have our hand on the spigot for other people's oil. After all, the oil of Iraq on the whole didn't in the past and needn't in the future go mainly to America. But we wanted to have control over Europe's oil, over China's oil, Japan's oil, and that's an incentive that remains. Even if we were marvelous on conservation and didn't need imported oil, which is a good direction to go in, the right direction, that doesn't mean we wouldn't have what they see as a vital interest in Iraq.
The important part is keeping it out of the hands of others.
What?
The important part is keeping it out of the hands of others.
Out of the hands of others. The fact that they're not getting much oil out of Iraq now is not a crucial disadvantage, so long as it's not going outside our auspices to China or Japan. In other words, we still control these other people's the oil they need through our corporations and our alliances.
My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Daniel Ellsberg, the American hero who leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. And, you know, one thing that we've been talking about, or it wasn't really a subject, but sort of came up offhand a couple of times in this interview, sir, is how much quicker everything is happening in the Iraq War as compared to Vietnam in terms of whistleblowers coming out like Karen Katowski and Sybil Edmonds, Catherine Gunn, and Joseph Darby. We've had lots of good whistleblowers so far. Whoever's leaking the memos over in England deserves all our thanks right now. And we also have, I think I heard Noam Chomsky comment that the number of people who were coming out to actively oppose the Iraq War before it even started was just absolutely unheard of if you compare that to the days of Vietnam, where even in 1969 it was hard to get, you know, everybody to come out to hear him speak or something like that. So
I agree with all that's quite true, yeah.
But I guess compared with what you were just saying before we went out to the break, that doesn't necessarily mean that the next guys in charge are going to do any better at getting us out of there.
I think it'll be very hard to get the U.S. out of Iraq. And it's going to take, I think, a worldwide movement and efforts by other countries as well to press us, which nobody's real eager to step up and press the world's richest and most powerful country from whom they need credit and aid and trade. And nevertheless, I think there will be increasing desire to rein us in somehow. And that'll probably take forms that have their own problems and are not very good in themselves at all. It'll lead to alliances that confront us, very possibly. But as far as in home, I think we need to learn a lot from the anti-war movement against Vietnam and learn how to do it better. Learn again to do the things that were effective there, ultimately bringing pressure on Congress and forcing Congress to use their constitutional powers in ways that they find risky personally to them or that can lead to their being called names. And we've got to provide a fire there under their bottoms that counteracts or, you know, that countervails the attacks they're going to get from the administration. And lead them to believe that they'll lose their jobs if they don't do what they want us to do, what we want them to do, I'm sorry, to cut off the funding for this war eventually. But we need to do it better than before. It took 10 years last time, and I think it'll take a lot longer. One thing about doing it better, I think, would be direct pressure on the media. The media are acting in such a cowardly and way, not entirely differently not that different from the American media at this stage of the war in Vietnam. And as you say, there's more criticism probably in the press now, especially if you see it on a widespread basis in a site like antiwar.com, which is my homepage, by the way. First thing I look at when I turn on the set. and CommonDreams.org, a few others, Truth Out, BuzzFlash. All these can give you a picture, a very good understanding, I think, of what's going on. Or Google News will give you it doesn't focus on critical stuff, and yet there's a lot of criticism out there in the world if you look for it in the right place. But so many papers simply ignore what's on the Internet, what their own fellow newspapers are saying on a given day. One paper may come out with an important expose. I think it would be good, and the others will ignore it. And I think, we were mentioning the Downing Street memos. Very few American papers have paid any attention to that at all. It was all over the British papers. Now, I think it would be good for citizens' committees as well as individuals in letters columns to the editor and to ombudsman. But I think also groups going to editorial staffs seeking an audience and laying this stuff on the table and saying, how come this is all over the British papers, or how come the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or the Boston Globe or Madison, Wisconsin or something has this story, and to you it's not news, or it doesn't exist? How do you explain that?
Now, that's a really good idea. A lot of us complain about the mass media a lot, and you know, we do our part, try to take part in it. But that's a great idea. Bring a group on down there to just confront them, lay the evidence on their table, and demand to know why it's not in the daily paper.
Yeah, even a little sit-in might, you never know, little tactics against the press, I think might get you some attention.
I really appreciate your emphasis on the House members, too. After all, they have to be reelected or unelected every 2 years, so they're really susceptible to our pressure if we push them.
Once you're doing the right thing, like Barbara Lee, right along here, and Dennis Kucinich is backing that.
Ron Paul.
Lynn Woolsey, Ron Paul of Texas. Has been very good on this subject right along. The people who do step out of line and are talking now about getting out, they need our support. And the others who are acting in this timid way need to be told that they'll lose their jobs, they'll be fired. There's an old saying in Washington, they may not see the light, but they'll feel the heat. I'll provide that heat.
Absolutely. All right, everybody. The book is an excellent book. I just finished reading it last night. It's called Secrets, A Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers by Daniel Ellsberg. His website is ellsberg.net, ellsberg.net, and truthtellingproject.org. Thank you so much for your time today, sir. I sure appreciate it.
Talk. Bye.
All right. Take good care, and we'll be right back with the bad news on the Weekend Interview Show.